The Nebraska Court of Appeals is now in session. May all who come here be heard. May truth and justice be served by what we do here.
Thank you. You may be seated. Good afternoon and welcome to the Nebraska Court of Appeals October session. I'm Mike Kirtle from Omaha. I'm pleased to be joined today on my left by Judge Frankie Moore of North Platte, and on my right by Judge Francie Reedman of Gretna. We have three cases today, and we will take them in the order listed. We ask that you leave your masks on until you come up to the podium to speak, and you may take the mask off for your oral argument. And once you're finished, if you would put it back on while you're in the courtroom, we'd appreciate that. When you leave today, I think we will have you leave through the side here, and in that way the next case can come in from the back without any traffic problems. Any questions by anyone before we get started? Again, remember we're live streaming this on NET. The arguments will be archived. If there's any sensitive or confidential information, you may want to refer to a party or a witness on a first name basis, but otherwise. Any questions?
No.
Questions over there?
No.
We have more than one appellee today, I believe.
Yes, sir.
And so how are you going to split your 10 minutes?
I am Adam B. I represent Peter Keller. I will go first and take 6 minutes.
Very good. All right. With that, we will get started. We'll call the first case, Summit Restoration, Inc. versus Keller et al. Please approach.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court counsel, good afternoon. My name is Eric Chandler. Excuse me. My name is Eric Chandler. I am here on behalf of the plaintiff appellant Summit Restoration Incorporated. If I may begin.
Yes, you may. I'm sorry.
Thank you. No, thank you. So I believe the issue has been pretty much outlined in our brief, which appellant's issue in this case, this is a case about our client, Summit Restoration Incorporated, filed multiple claims against the defendants for tortious interference, breach of fiduciary duty, breach of duty of loyalty, and then, of course, the civil conspiracy because there were multiple individuals involved. The sole issue on appeal is that Summit Restoration was successful. We were successful at trial. The jury returned a verdict of over $396,000. And then later on defendant's motion, that verdict was remitted to, I believe, it was remitted to $260,000. Our appeal is based solely on that issue. And the issue is there was sufficient evidence in the record to support the jury's verdict of $396,000.
So, counsel, if I understand what the trial court did was, they took your demonstrative exhibit that showed the minimum amount that you believe the jury could award. Is that right?
Yes. Well, and Judge Reedman, I'm not sure I 100% understand your question, but I guess that exhibit was never actually offered into evidence.
Right. It was a demonstrative one.
Correct.
And you used it during closing.
That is correct.
Okay. So the jury was given that number and told that that was the minute. That's their starting point. Right?
Correct.
So your theory that that number showed damages, including the 30% profit, but they could go up to 45%.
Yes, essentially what, and if you read through, and I believe both appellee briefs clearly misstate what happened at trial, as you can see in the record if you read through the bill of exceptions. If you actually look at my closing argument, what was stated was to the jury is, this is your starting point. That's exactly what I said. And then I said, it's up to you whether this is essentially what it was, is basically a codification of the information that was provided through actual evidence, because there were thousands of exhibits, thousands of pages. So essentially, this was to make it easier for the fact finder saying, hey, if you look through all these exhibits, these are the numbers that you're going to find in here. And then once you look through and you determine what damages that plaintiff has suffered or if we're going to win, it's up to you to decide also then, based on the evidence that you've heard, what percentage you apply. And then if you look back through the Bill of Exceptions, the president of Summit Restoration Incorporated, Aaron Cantor, had testified repeatedly over and over again, at least 30%, at least 30%, at least 30%. And that's where that 30% comes from. And at some point, I believe appellees had even referenced in their brief saying where they had asked Mr. Cantor a leading question on cross. Well, so you and you're looking for this 30%, and then he says yes, and then they're like, oh, he admitted it's 30%. But if you look through the totality of his testimony, he even goes into an explanation where he talks about, I believe I asked him, this might not be exact, but essentially it was, well, what is your profit margin? He says it's 30% all the way up to 45%. And then the question was, well, why is it sometimes 30%? Why is it sometimes up to 45%? And his response was, insurance work pays more, that we won't do a job unless it's at least 30%. And then he talks about bidding cash jobs and how a cash job is typically going to be at least a 30% profit margin, whereas insurance work pays more, up to 45%. Then he also went in to testify, and it was conceded at trial or not contested, that all of the 17 jobs, all the jobs that plaintiff was claiming were taken at trial, they were all insurance work. They were all related to insurance claims.
So is it your position that all insurance work was at 45%?
My position is that, or our position is that, based on the law, it's clear that, so we have the liability, it's clear that damages were suffered. Once the damages are suffered, it's up to the jury to make their determination based on the best evidence. The evidence they had is that this profit margin, which everyone knows profit margins are not always going to be exact. They're not going to be exact per job. So this profit margin where he says is 30 to 45% and then talks about how with insurance, it's going to be towards the higher end, that it was fully within the province of the jury to assess the damages and apply any percentage they wanted to within that 30 to 45%. And that the higher range actually made more sense based on the testimony they heard and the fact that all of the evidence that was entered had to do with insurance work. And Mr. Cantor had testified that insurance work results in a higher profit margin.
I guess where I'm struggling a little bit is, how does the jury determine where between 30% and 45%? The reason my question before of, is it your position that all insurance work was 45 and therefore the jury could and should have given 45? Or is it somewhere along the spectrum of 30 to 45? And if so, how does the jury make the determination?
I think by giving them a spectrum, especially an uncontested spectrum, and if you look solely at the evidence at trial, that as long as they have the evidence, they can make that determination. And arguably, unfortunately, we didn't have this in evidence, but arguably, I think if there was a contractor here today, they would tell you that it's typically more than 45% right now for insurance work. But if that's in evidence, I mean, if I'm a contractor in any industry and I know, okay, I'm not going to do this job unless I'm certain that I'm going to hit at least 30%. I'm hoping I'm going to make at least 35. On a good job, I'm going to make 45. The case law states once we've established the damages, it doesn't have to be within mathematical certainty. And that's the reality that we live in, is these spectrums. So once Mr. Cantor provided that spectrum, and it's a reasonable spectrum, and he does say it's going to be towards the higher, I would say that as long as they're not going above the 45%, then they're okay. And that is reasonable. And in this case, that's not what they did. I mean, they were within the range. All of the cases cited in both briefs, or in all the briefs, that reference any issue along those lines, they're all clearly distinguishable. I believe one of them was, there was the Nebraska Truck Services and Sales case that had to do with an insurance contract where a plaintiff actually lost on appeal. They didn't enter any evidence of damages. They never had anyone actually present any documents or any testimony as to the value of the truck. In the cases where there actually was a verdict that was remitted, for instance, the Alfredo case, in those situations, if you look at what the court did, the appellate court, What they did is they remitted it to the max amount of damages that was provided for in evidence. So in Alfredo, for instance, the district court remitted the verdict to the maximum dollar amount that plaintiff showed in damages within the evidence at trial. They did the same thing in the other, and I apologize because I can't remember what exact case this is, but there was one other case cited where it was actually a breach of contract action, and it was a salesperson suing under his sales contract where they had entered evidence at trial asking for a specific amount of damage. I believe it was $22,000. The jury awarded $29,000, and when they went back and read through closing, it actually said, we want 22, here's 22. So in all of those cases, the court has come back and essentially said, we're only remitting the damages down to the maximum amount that could have been allowed. So for instance, in this situation, if the jury would have came back with $500,000, then I believe the district court would have clearly been reasonable in reducing it to that $402,000 amount, saying there's not evidence to support $500,000. But once you go through and you look at the evidence and you see that there is evidence that supports the verdict and it supports it based on a 45% profit margin, and then you look that the jury determined 45% profit margin, all we have is the district court substituting their judgment for that jury. If that's going to be the standard, then why even submit the issue of damages to the jury in the first place? After we hit liability, why don't we just send it to the district court and have them make their determination?
Do we know, based upon the jury verdict, what percentage of profit they gave?
We don't. So all of this is pure speculation. And with that, I'd like to reserve any remaining time for a vote. Thank you.
May it please the court. I represent Mr. Larry Keller, who is an appellee and a cross appellant. I will respond to the main appeal first. So Mr. Chandler said an interesting thing just now, that the case law cited by appellees says that a jury award may be remitted down to the maximum amount supported by the evidence in the record. That's exactly what happened in this case. You heard a lot of talk about a profit margin between 30 and 45%, but on cross-examination, Mr. Chandler referenced this, the president of Summit Restoration, the plaintiff, admitted that as to the 17 jobs that were at issue in this case, not other hypothetical jobs, the profit margin he expected was 30%. So there was no non-speculative basis for the jury to go above 30%. And there was a good question, well, how would the jury decide where to go between 30 and 45%? How could they land on 34 or 43%? There was no basis for them to do that because there was no testimony in the record that as to these specific jobs at issue in this case, there was a profit margin expected at that particular percentage. And another thing that's really important to note is that this court's review is on abuse of discretion. That's the Barbour case. And the reason for that is because the judge who is in the room and can hear all the testimony come in and is familiar with all the evidence is the person who is in the best position to make a determination like this. And that's exactly what the district court did. When the jury verdict came in, it was not supported by the record. It used, who knows? I mean, that's what Mr. Chandler just admitted. We don't know what profit margin they used, but the only possible profit margin that could be applied would be 30% because that's what the president of Summit Restoration admitted he was expecting as to those specific jobs, and there was no testimony otherwise.
Didn't Mr. Cantor also testify, though, that he expected on his jobs to earn 30 to 45%? Insurance jobs were on the higher end, and all of these were insurance jobs.
Yeah, I believe there was some testimony to that effect. But again, that's as to, you know, his line of work in general. We don't know what would distinguish a job where you would get 45% versus 30%, whether you're working with different insurance companies. There was no basis in the record to make a determination as to where things fell. And again, he specifically admitted that as to these particular 17 jobs that were at issue in the litigation, that's what he was expecting to get. That's the only evidence in the record on that issue. And so for the jury to go above that, there was no non-speculative basis for them to do that. it was completely appropriate for the district court to revert to reduce the award on that basis. Now I'd like to move on to Mr. Keller's cross appeal. And we believe that you don't even have to get to the issue of the propriety of the remittiture, because the true answer is that the damages should be zero. And there's a couple of key reasons for this. One is that, and just to give the court a little background on this, so a little refresher. So my client, Mr. Keller, worked for Summit Restoration. That was a plaintiff company. He quit on June 22nd, a Sunday. He goes to join Aspen, a competitor. And the evidence is undisputed that none of these 17 jobs at issue were solicited by anybody at Aspen. And again, there's no evidence that Larry Keller himself even did this until after Larry left Summit Restoration. So
did he not reference these jobs, though, in his correspondence with Aspen personnel before he left?
The jury may have been able to infer that, but that's irrelevant because at that point, all of his duties to Summit ended. And a key thing to remember is that there was no non-solicitation agreement in place, no confidentiality agreement, no non-compete. And the identity of these roofing jobs, which were jobs that resulted from a hailstorm where everybody knew where it was, Mr. Cantor, the president of Summit Restoration, admitted the location of the jobs was not any sort of confidential secret. So at that point, he was a privileged competitor under Nebraska law. And thus, to find liability for tortious interference, and again, all his duty of good faith and fair dealing or duty of loyalty or whatever applied, and we dispute what duties apply, but that doesn't even matter. All those duties are gone. So to find liability as to these particular 17 jobs, there has to be something wrongful about his conduct. And it can't just be that Summit talked to a few homeowners and then Mr. Keller left and went and talked to the same homeowners. It has to be something more. And there's nothing in the record that supports any breach of duty by Mr. Keller during the time period over here where he was actually working for Summit and owed duties to Summit. And, you know, in the briefing, there's three documents that Summit relied upon at trial that really are the thinnest possible reads, but we don't think there are any reads, and we explain all that in the briefing. But for 14 of these 17 jobs, there's nothing. There's nothing in the record whatsoever that shows any breach by Mr. Keller of any duty or any wrongful comment or conduct while he was a member of Summit Restoration and owed duties to Summit.
What about the testimony of the Dropbox that the people at Summit were able to literally watch their case, their clients move out of their Dropbox and into your clients?
Well, again, there's nothing wrongful about Aspen or Mr. Keller or anybody going after these same 17 homeowners. There's nothing wrongful about what that whatsoever in the absence of a non-compete agreement, non-solicitation agreement, or anything of that nature. And there's no evidence that any documents that Summit had, A, are confidential in nature or would give some sort of unfair business advantage, or B, were actually used by Summit to do the job. And in fact, if you look at Exhibit 64, the split between the paperwork that Summit had when it was doing its sort of pre-work on these jobs, and sometimes it's only a couple of contact listings, and then you look at the Aspen side of the ledger, the Aspen side of the ledger is much thicker. They used their own documents. They ran their own reports. So there's no evidence linking any of these things between Summit and Aspen. And I see that I've actually gone into Mr. Nix's time, so I would like to yield the floor to him. Thank you.
And please, the court. I'm Jeffrey Nix, and I represent the appellees and cross appellants Aspen Contracting, ASI Contracting, and Patrick Nusbeck. I would just like to address briefly the prejudicial error that occurred during the trial. My client Aspen, ASI, and Patrick Nusbeck never had any employment relationship, never had any fiduciary or special relationship with the plaintiff. The co-defendant, Mr. Keller, did work for the plaintiff at one time, and we ended up hiring him. And then after he was hired, then he began to solicit work with competitors, as he was free to do so. But the court included a couple of jury instructions on both number 10 and 17 regarding a fiduciary relationship, breach of a fiduciary relationship, which was objected to. There was no attempt by the court to explain to the jury that there was no fiduciary relationship whatsoever between my clients and the plaintiffs. And when you couple that with the verdict forms, which were also objected to, the jury, with those instructions in the verdict form, could easily conclude, well, there must have been a fiduciary relationship between my clients and the plaintiff, some special kind of relationship that was breached. That was simply not the case. And in this particular case, the jury then had the opportunity to consider, well, I guess Mr. Keller, I guess all the defendants had a special fiduciary relationship, even though the evidence didn't show that. My clients had any kind of relationship. We had no duty of loyalty, no duty of fiduciary responsibility whatsoever to the plaintiff. And yet, with those two instructions plus the verdict forms, which were all three objected to, it created prejudicial error because it's very easy for the jury to be confused on that issue and conclude, well, I guess a fiduciary relationship did exist.
Could a jury not, though, have also found that Mr. Keller engaged in interference with these contracts and then through the theory of civil conspiracy held remaining?
Well, that's possible, but the problem with that, in my view, based on the law that I cited and I think that is existing, is that fiduciary relationship is a special relationship, and the contents of it, the particulars of it are only known between the fiduciaries. That's not something that we had knowledge of or could any way have conspired to interfere with. So it's untenable under any kind of legal theory, but especially in the way that the jury instructions and verdict form were presented to the jury. It left them basically putting my clients as if they had been a former employee of the plaintiff, which was never the case.
But is a fiduciary relationship necessary in a civil conspiracy situation?
Well, when you're talking about interfering with a unique, special relationship, which is what they're claiming, I believe that is. I see my time's up. Thank you.
We have some time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, 56 seconds.
All right, very good.
Thank you. I just ask that you read the testimony. It's clear. The profit margin was laid out. There was evidence. It was 30 to 45%. As far as in response to counsel's arguments regarding the jury instructions, the fiduciary duty, the issue at trial, and I believe the jury instructions read correctly, is that Mr. Nussbeck was charged with the civil conspiracy, as Judge Reedman alluded to, and helping Mr. Keller to essentially violate his fiduciary duty. He was labeled as CEO. He ran the company. Everyone knew he was the CEO. And responding to other counsel, as far as plaintiff only relying on a few exhibits, there's thousands of pages of exhibits. There's a reference to a lien release, and I believe even one of the briefs states, well, the lien release wouldn't have been important because it's releasing a future lien of some. Exactly. The whole point was he released that lien. Mr. Keller released that lien on June 19th. He released it before he left so that it wouldn't interfere with Aspen taking the business. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. We will take the case under advisement. And with that, we will allow you to leave through the side here. We appreciate you being here and ask that you travel safely. Thank you.
Thank you.